Before we get into today's podcast, I wanted to let you know about a special ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Five Ways to Connect with God, Ancient Practices for Modern Times. It's safe to say that in today's fast-paced culture, we're all seeking more rest and less chaos. Only then can we find true connection with our Creator. Five Ways to Connect to God offers five unique spiritual principles to Christians who may be feeling dry when it comes to their prayer life or spiritual fervor. These include practices such as choosing a word for the year, the power of one-phrase prayers, and the importance of cultivating thankfulness. Some of these principles are hundreds of years old, yet they offer a fresh way to connect us with the living God. Download your copy of Five Ways to Connect to God by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
Today we're going to talk about everyone's favourite subject, not coronavirus. Yeah, was once dominated this podcast, I remember, which launched just as lockdown began 4 years ago. We spent months and months talking about little else than COVID, but life seems to have moved on very quickly.
But and here it's in interesting, the UK, isn't it? Yeah, I'm sort of thinking, don't switch off now. Why is it that as soon as you say we're going to do something on COVID, you think, oh, really?
Yeah. People have just very much moved on with a capital M, capital O, haven't they? And no one wants to think or talk about it anymore, which is one of the things we'll discuss today. But despite the public's wider lack of interest, there is here in the UK an official COVID inquiry is well underway and has been going on for some time. And some of the testimony in recent kind of weeks has been really striking as they're kind of talking to senior doctors and others working in the NHS at the height of the first and second waves of the pandemic about some of their experiences. And it's a really sobering reminder for those of us like me who spend literally 0 minutes every day thinking about COVID, just how horrendous this incredibly recent catastrophe was.
Yeah. So just recently, last week, Professor Kevin Fong, who was and is a very senior emergency doctor, former clinical advisor in emergency preparedness, he said he was on shift at the time of the 7/7 London bombings. But he said that nothing in his previous experience had prepared him for the scale of death in hospitals at the height of the pandemic.
Hmm. And so Fong was giving evidence to the inquiry, and he, as well as being a consultant himself, he, because of this job he had working for kind of NHS HQ at the time, he would regularly visit intensive care units to kind of get a sense of what was going on the front line during the pandemic. And he said, describing his first visit in April 2020, Fong said this: "It was very memorable. I was greeted at the entrance by one of the intensive care registrars. I asked him immediately what things had been like. I'll never forget. He replied, 'It's been like a terrorist attack every day since this started, and we don't know when the attacks are going to stop.' The scale of death experienced by the intensive care teams during COVID was unlike anything they'd ever seen before. They're no strangers to death. They are the intensive care unit. They look after some of the sickest patients in the hospital, but the scale of death was truly, truly astounding. We had nurses talking about patients raining from the sky. One of the nurses told me they were just got tired of putting people in body bags. They were so overwhelmed that they were putting patients in body bags, lifting them from the bed, putting them on the floor, and then immediately putting another patient into that bed straight away because there wasn't time." And he goes on talking about how some hospitals got so bad they actually ran out of body bags. And so instead they just were given these clear plastic sacks and cable ties, which was incredibly traumatizing for the nurses because they felt like they were throwing people away into the bin. And he said also some of the nurses had to wear adult diapers because there was literally no one there or no time to go to the toilet. And so they were literally, you know, excreting standing up while on the job, and others were going to kind of DIY stop to try and buy some visors because they hadn't been given enough protective equipment. So, and he himself, you know, Fong repeatedly broke down in tears while giving evidence to the inquiry, even if he's mostly, passing on accounts of what happened to other people. So clearly an incredibly kind of harrowing time, which most of us don't really reflect on.
Yeah, and I remember at the time I was in touch with a number of junior doctors in particular, and they were expressing some of these feelings. It was made much worse, of course, by the fact that relatives and other people were not allowed to come into the wards.
Mm.
And so not only did the doctors, many of them very junior, I remember at the time they said, okay, finally a medical student, we now declare you a qualified doctor, forget about exams and all that kind of stuff, and you are on duty, turn up on Monday to the intensive care unit. I mean, extraordinary things, you know. And so the emotions of watching people die and then having to hold up or communicate the news via a smartphone or hold up a smartphone or an iPad so that somebody could have their final vision of their dying loved one, you know, mothers, fathers, grands, grannies, granddads. And, just how traumatizing that whole event was. It must have seemed, and it did seem like to people who were there, like just like from another world, a horror movie.
Mm. Yeah. And the kind of relentless grind of it, you know, I was very struck by what he was saying. You know, he'd worked during the 7/7 bombings. You know, if people will recall, the three tube trains and a bus were blown up in one morning in central London, and 50 odd people were killed and hundreds more injured. And, you know, all the central London hospitals were kind of slightly overwhelmed by these very critically ill people suddenly arriving all at once. But, you know, it happens once. And then, you know, you have to surge and try and respond. And then, you know, within a few days, people have either died or been stabilized and kind of things go back to normal. But the idea of having to do that day after day after day, and, you know, as people are stabilized or die, and the next day another 50 people arrive with critical symptoms. And it's just, I can only imagine how unbelievably draining and traumatizing and, harrowing that must be to come into work knowing full well you've got another 12-hour shift of trying to desperately keep these seriously ill people alive, and it will be exactly the same the day after tomorrow.
And of course you've then got the moral decision, do I call off sick? You know, I'm terribly, I can't sleep, I'm having nightmares, I've got PTSD, you know, I'm not fit to work. Do I call in sick and say I won't go to work today, I'll just, you know, they can't force me. But on the other hand, I know that my colleagues are just desperately short-staffed. So this kind of moral dilemma, I've got young children at home, I've got elderly vulnerable people at home, you know, am I bringing back an infection to them? You know, what are my responsibilities?
Yeah, absolutely. And in putting your own life on the line, this is an era before, you know, we had no vaccine, we knew very little about COVID-19. And so people are going in, receiving kind of potentially super doses, being constantly reinfected because they had very inadequate PPE and protective equipment. I heard stories of some doctors and nurses who decided it was too risky to go home and didn't want to risk giving an elderly relative who was living with them or their children COVID. And so they would just sleep in the hospital and spent weeks, you know, not only doing this incredibly draining job, but not actually having any respite at home, not having any contact beyond phone calls with their loved ones out of fear that they might have caught this deadly virus and didn't want to pass it on. So a kind of a hard to wrap from those of us who were just, you know, sitting at home on Zoom calls and plugging away as usual, it's hard to wrap your head around just what an extraordinary period of time this was for people in healthcare.
Yeah, a friend of mine was a consultant working in a big hospital, and a colleague of his, a late middle-aged Indian man, I think it was an ENT
ear, nose and throat.
He had examined, been involved with assessing someone with an airway problem with COVID early on in the, you know, trying to save their life. He'd got infected. He'd ended up on the intensive care unit and had died. And the ripples that go around then the staff that, you know, one of our own, you know, and this might be me the next time I'm examining a patient. Is this going to be me? Am I, you know, and is that a wise thing to do? Wouldn't it be, shouldn't I be protecting my own health first of all, rather than exposing myself and so on?
And yet the vast, vast majority of people in these kind of caring professions did take the self-sacrificial decision to carry on coming into work and to carry on putting themselves in harm's way for the sake of others, which I think speaks to something about the kind of sacrificial ethos that runs through healthcare in particular, but, you know, essentially some of the other caring professions, where people were, even some, you know, very high status, well-paid kind of elite doctors, were prepared to come in day after day, putting their potentially put their lives on the line for total strangers being wheeled in with COVID, which I think is not only, you know, massive to their credit, but it says something quite interesting about what the kind of potentially kind of Christianized ethos that there is in medicine.
Well, it is. And I remember at the time we talked about the fact that if you go back to the eras of plague before the Christian era, when these plagues used to sweep in through the ancient Roman cities and the Greek cities and so on, the standard teaching amongst or the standard practice anyway amongst the doctors and the Hippocratic physicians was the most important thing was to run for the hills, you know, that it was very bad to look after dying patients. It was particularly bad, one, because you might get infected, and two, because it was bad for your reputation as a physician. I mean, if if your patients die on your watch, you know, what does that say about you as a doctor? So it was generally agreed that both for your own protection and for professional reputation, the most important thing was to run for the hills.
Yeah.
And yet here we had, you know, these first-hand accounts of what happened to these non-professional Christian carers in the middle of cities with plague, and lo and behold, instead of running for the hills, they go out and bring the pagan people into their own homes. They care for them, they look after them. Many of them get infected and some of them die, and yet this was their extraordinary Christian response.
And that's the kind of common story in all pre-Christian society, isn't it, that those who have money and wealth and independence and agency look after number one when there are times of pandemic, times of plague, as we would call it. You know, they flee for the hills, they batten down their castle walls and they refuse to let anyone in or share any of their resources and wait for the thing to ride it out. And that wouldn't even be kind of understood as selfish. That would just be totally ordinary public ethics. That's how people act. And we, I think, are so seeped in a kind of post-Christian culture here in the West, at least, that it is unthinkable that, you know, an NHS doctor might say, do you know what, I don't want to go into hospital today and risk my life looking after patients. I'm going to batten down the hatches and survive at home. That would be absolutely castigated as the height of kind of moral cowardice and selfishness. And you know, the vast majority of people on both sides, those criticizing and those who are doing this self-sacrifice, but they weren't Christians at all. And yet somehow unconsciously it feels like they're almost living out a kind of cross-shaped ethic, something about what they've been trained in, what they understand the job of a physician, of a doctor, of a nurse is to put your needs second before those of, you know, the homeless man who's been wheeled in on a stretcher and needs ventilation or whatever.
That's absolutely right. And it, in fact, it's very clear in those early Christian accounts that it all goes back to the example of Jesus. You know, because Jesus was a healer, he was a carer, and he touched the lepers. He made himself ritually unclean. He exposed himself to risk, and he said, "Greater love has no one than this, than they lay down their life for their friends." And then he lived it out. He gave his life, and not only for his friends but also for his enemies. And so that model of a healer who is there for others and who is prepared to bring risk upon themselves. That was such a powerful model and vision and ideal for the Christian healer. And that's been so right from the beginning. You know, it was the Christians who set up plague hospitals, staffed by priests and by lay brothers and sisters. And it's been there for 2,000 years. That has been the ethos, which then passed into Western medical tradition.
Yeah, and praise God for it, I think. And I think what is fascinating to me, however, is that, you know, there was lots of love and affection from the general population at the time. You know, we talked about before, the slightly infamous clap for carers ritual kind of developed where on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. or something like that, everyone would go on their front door while locked down and bang their pots and pans across the country inexplicably. It was a very strange period of time. But even, you know, I remember that when the Premier League resumed in lockdown, you know, they all the players had these badges on their sleeves with a little blue heart and the letters NHS. And there was this kind of outpouring of affection and for our frontline workers. But it's all fizzled away. And what is so striking to me is you know, you have these news stories and there is clearly very interesting things going on at the COVID inquiry and these harrowing stories coming out of it. And yet the rest of the world kind of, or the society kind of moves on with barely a flicker of interest. You know, why do we think no one else is talking about COVID anymore? Why do you think even these kind of powerful, gripping human stories of unbelievable self-sacrifice in the hardest of times barely kind of raise a flicker of interest beyond a few?
Yeah, and just before we get there, I think it's important to recognise that a lot of the unrest, dissatisfaction, low morale within the health service and within health service workers is because they feel that their sacrifice was never really recognised. I mean, a lot of the drive for, you know, the strikes, junior doctor strikes, for the drive to get better pay and conditions, and indeed a lot of people leaving the health service, a lot of people resigning, a lot of health workers going elsewhere, is because of this sense that they paid this enormous sacrifice and it was never really properly recognised, particularly by politicians and managers, but also by the public as a whole.
Yeah. And that continues to this day. I think that people don't want to think about it. And my take on that is that this is a kind of collective willful amnesia that people were so, you know, obviously traumatized is a strong word in comparison to, you know, having to put dead bodies in bin bags and what, you know, healthcare staff faced with. But I think everyone, to some extent, was mildly traumatized by the experience of being locked down and fearful of an invisible virus that you couldn't see and being separated from your loved ones for months and the idea that a hug could be a deadly vector of disease. You know, all this stuff, it was very traumatizing and unsettling. And people are so desperately relieved that it's in the past. I think there is an almost unspoken agreement in society that we're just not going to think and talk about it very much anymore because no one wants to go back there. No one wants to remember.
It's a very understandable reaction, isn't it? I mean, you can see that tendency. Let's just pretend it didn't happen. Let's just live as though, you know, yes, it was terrible, but for goodness sake, what's the point in raking over the coals? Let's get on. Let's live our new lives. Let's forget about it. And yet, there's this very important thing about memorialization, about remembering the fallen, about celebrating those of previous generations who gave their lives for the community. And of course, this is very well recognized, isn't it, in military circles. I mean, that since the Great War or before, there's been this instinct of memorializing the fallen.
Yeah, which I think is so woven into modern society, we don't really realize how historically actually quite recent that is. You know, I did a bit of study on this in my history degree about kind of popular memory and you know, people have always put up personal memorials, you know, to loved ones who've died. But the kind of, for many centuries, the kind of public things were very much for like heroic individuals, you know. So, you know, putting up a statue to Admiral Nelson after he died because he was a kind of beloved public figure, you know, this fighting in the war against the French, won us some battles. But the thousands of ordinary soldiers who died at the Battle of Trafalgar are nowhere to be seen. And they're
these equestrian statues, aren't they, of sort of the great leaders on a horse.
Exactly.
Spurring on into battle.
Yes. And the idea of the fact that, but there was very little memorialization of the kind of 99.9% of people who actually die in war, which tend to be the kind of poor, the underclass, the dispossessed, not the kind of elite aristocrats on horseback. And that's very interesting how that began to change. Interestingly, the historians trace a lot of it in the West back to the American Civil War, which is often seen as kind of one of the first kind of modern industrialized mass wars, where you had conscription, not the First World War conscription, of course, but where conscription across a kind of relatively modern industrialized society on both sides. It was kind of total war, you know, where it wasn't being fought between small armies of 1,000 or 2,000 men on a distant field. And they would, you know, line up in two ranks and shoot each other until one of them survived. And then they would declare a victor. The American Civil War was a kind of total war. It was an economic war. The armies were hundreds of thousands strong. And they caused hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of casualties. And this prompted this kind of upsurge, actually, on both Confederate and the federal side to kind of, we need to say something about our boys who are dying, these ordinary farmhands and factory workers who are dying. And so even something, you know, the very famous Gettysburg Address that Lincoln, kind of one of the most famous speeches in modern times, that was actually during the war, but it was at the opening of a memorial to the Battle of Gettysburg. And it's just one of the first times where the memorial is not to the general who is in charge of the forces, but it remembers all of those who died. And there was very conscious decision making around this time to kind of shift how we do memorialization, where we're going to find all the bodies of everyone who died, and we're going to put a simple cross in front of all of them and put it on a big national kind of graveyard. And all the crosses will be indistinguishable. They won't be bigger and fancier for those who are richer and more powerful, who are higher rank. It's all the sense that everyone died and everyone gets to be remembered equally. And this obviously then goes up a ratchet around the First World War, when there's even more so on all sides, you know, tens of millions of soldiers, of ordinary conscripted men dying. And there's this growth of the, you know, the wearing a red poppy to remember each year. Remembrance Day becomes an institution. And then ultimately it leads to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which many countries kind of pick up on and have something like this. So we've moved so far from the kind of equestrian, here's a statue of the great war hero returning victorious or died triumphant, glorious martyr, to this is the memorial of someone. We don't even know the name of the remains of the person inside here, but they stand in for all of us. They're the everyman. They are the avatar of the soul of Britain, which died in the trenches. And we're going to keep the flame burning 365 days a year. We're going to pause in a 2-minute silence. It becomes embedded in society that it is really important to remember what happened, to face into the horrors of those First World War and remember what the people suffered.
I've never really thought about this before, but it's worth just pointing out how profoundly Christian that is, that every single life is of equal value. Mm. I mean, that simply
is a radical idea.
It doesn't make sense in the history that celebrates the heroes.
No.
And the idea that, I never knew that before about Arlington National Cemetery, that you would have exactly the same significance of an unknown private as the great hero. That is such a Christian idea, that each of us is made in God's image. Each of us has a unique value. And it's interesting. I mean, did they ever make that link in the American Civil War that with Christianity? I mean, there was a kind of national sort of Christianity light, wasn't there, in the founding of the...
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at the text of the Gettysburg Address, where Lincoln is, you know, he says this: we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether our nation, conceived in liberty, et cetera, can long endure. We met on a great battlefield of that war. So they'd come back to the battlefield where the Gettysburg battle had been. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those here who gave their lives that the nation might live. You know, so a very explicit idea of they died so we might live. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. So it's the idea of the kind of almost the holiness of dying, the blood sacrifice in battle. And it goes on, you know, that we here highly resolve that the dead shall not die in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government by the people, of the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. I mean, it's brilliant rhetoric, but clearly a highly Christianized idea that there is a kind of the sacral memorialization of death in conflict, that, you know, a soldier who gives his blood on the battlefield, in some sense, is following in the footsteps of Jesus, who gave his blood on the cross for us.
All of us have wondered what happens when we die, and I'm excited to say that N.T. Wright has written an amazing book called Surprised by Hope that provides a fresh perspective and incredible insight on this crucial subject. This powerful book is our gift to you today to say thank you for your financial support of Premier Insight this month. Dive deep into the biblical understanding of life after death and how it can transform your life today. Supplies are limited, so don't miss out. So go now to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Don't forget to request your copy of Surprised by Hope. Thanks for your support.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And certainly this tradition, and certainly in the UK, it's still strongly linked, isn't it? This annual memorial remembrance service, it's very much linked in with the Church of England.
Yeah, I mean, it's Remembrance Sunday. You know, even if the 11th of December is not a Sunday, the nearest Sunday to it is designated Remembrance Sunday because it has to involve a church service.
And the cenotaph is a service again, isn't it? It is put within the context of faith. You know, however much this creates it creates all kinds of ambiguities for those who are against violence and conscientious objectors and all the rest. But there is a Christian instinct here, and it's just interesting to compare that with the lack of memorialization for COVID.
There is no national cenotaph for COVID. There is no, you know, simple symbol that we wear on one day a year to remember COVID. I mean, there is this wall. Have you come across the COVID memorial wall in central London along the banks of the Thames, where they've painted tiny red hearts, like one for each person who died or something like that? But it was actually an entirely kind of spontaneous grassroots effort that's been kind of only kind of latterly co-opted by the state and become the official memorial. But it's very kind of ad hoc, temporary thing.
Yeah, I interestingly, even living in London, I wasn't really aware of it. But as you say, it was something entirely done by bereaved volunteers and maintained, known as Friends of the Wall. They repaint faded hearts and rewrite dedications, remove graffiti, look after the wall to ensure that those lost to COVID in the UK are remembered as people, not as statistics. So it's very much a grassroots movement. And it is interesting to ask the question, why don't the politicians and the elite leaders of our country, they haven't... Is it because, unfortunately, COVID became highly politicised and is still seen as almost a toxic topic to get involved with?
Yeah, I think that certainly has got a part of it. You know, people might remember in the early days there was this kind of, you know, national emergency rally to the flag, kind of almost like in wartime, you know, where, you know, the government surges to kind of unprecedented approval ratings because people are just like, we're all pulling together. But it only really lasted a few months, and then it started to fizzle away, and then there were kind of, for the rest of the 2 years COVID really lasted, there was these kind of quite bitter political disagreements about what the right response is. Should we be locking down harder, less hard? What about vaccines? What about masks? It became a culture war topic of contention, right v left, you know, woke v anti-woke. And I suspect that has really poisoned efforts to try to kind of unite the nation around, you know, how would you begin to remember COVID? You know, some people would say, well, we need to remember that it was caused by the fecklessness and the incompetence of our politicians. And, you know, they failed us, and they want to remember the ordinary people, you know, donkey lions led by donkeys. But then there's some people who say we want to remember it as a crisis when we had our liberty stolen from us by the state, and never again will we allow the state to lock us in our own homes. And it's very, very awkward and contested to find a simple narrative. Whereas war is, there is contested, but basically with the First World War, you know, the narrative was, let's remember those who died so that it doesn't happen again. Yeah. Everyone agreed in 1918. Let's make sure we can't let this happen again, which is, of course, we now know with the tragedy of hindsight, they failed. But like that was, fairly broadly shared. It wasn't triumphalist. It was, let's remember those who had died so we don't let it happen again.
And the same narrative happened in the Second World War, didn't it? The war to end all wars. This is, you know, we are creating a future fit for heroes, you know, and so on. So unfortunately, that narrative recurs. But I was just, again, reflecting that there were conspiracy theories going around that the whole thing was a hoax. Yeah. And I was just reading about a study of how a single tweet spawned a COVID-19 conspiracy theory on Twitter. So apparently in the late March of 2020, which is sort of early on in the pandemic.
Very early on, yeah.
A new hashtag, which was called #FilmYourHospital, made its first appearance on social media. The hashtag encouraged people to visit local hospitals to take pictures and videos of empty hospitals to help prove that the COVID-19 pandemic was an elaborate hoax. Using techniques from social network analysis, they found that much of the content came from users with very limited social media reach, but the oxygen that fueled this conspiracy in its early days came from a handful of prominent conservative politicians and far-right political activists on Twitter. And these power users used the hashtag #FilmYourHospital to build awareness about the end campaign, to encourage their followers to break quarantine and film what was happening at their local hospitals. After the initial boost, the campaign was mostly sustained by pro-Trump accounts, followed by a secondary wave of propagation outside the US. And so this conspiracy theory, and I remember there were people posting, you know, well, I went along to my NHS hospital and I took pictures in the middle of the night and the corridors were empty. So that just proves that the whole thing is an elaborate hoax.
Yeah. And even more painful for those doctors who were, you know, putting patients in bin bags and improvising visors and battling a terrorist attack load of new patients every day. When they finally get off shift to be met by cranks outside in the streets calling them, you know, crisis actors and just horrendous stuff.
It's mind-boggling.
But I think, that's an example of kind of denialism in the moment, right? This isn't a thing, this is not happening. It was relatively fringe, not as fringe as it should have been, but I think most people agree that there was a thing called COVID. But I think what is happening now is the opposite of that kind of memorialization. It's a denialism of the past and saying it happened, but we want to leave it in the past. You know, what was so striking about the kind of modern memorialization of war is it's saying all these people have come back from the trenches in the First World War, broken mentally and physically. And the instinct for a lot of people is going to be, well, let's just put that behind us and move on. And yet the poppy and the annual remembrance and the 2 minute silence and the cenotaph and the tomb of the unknown soldier and all of this is a deliberate way of forcing society, including those who didn't actually experience the war, who were safe at home, of not forgetting, of kind of forcing themselves to stare into the abyss of modern industrialized trench conflict and how awful it is, so that it doesn't happen again. And that's the exact opposite of what our society is doing now with COVID. We're not forcing ourselves to listen to people like Kevin Fong and the doctors who went through this harrowing experience. We are saying, blah, 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 can't hear you, moving on, it's all over, no thank you, don't want to talk about it.
And yet, you know, trying to think from a Christian perspective, there clearly is this very strong theme that runs throughout the whole Bible of memorialization. Remember what God did you. In the Old Testament, it's the Passover, and also the escape from Egypt, isn't it? Which becomes the event, which is memorialized, celebrated, and you had to every year remember what happened. You had to teach your children. You had to celebrate the event, and of course, then into the New Testament, and Jesus takes that same kind of Passover meal and the memorialization of the Passover meal, and then says, "This is my body, which is given for you. This is my blood shed for you." So memorialization is very deeply rooted into Christian thinking. You know, why is that? Why is it so important to remember?
I just remembered the Israelites are told to raise a stone, at the point where they cross the Jordan into the promised land. God says, put up a stone, build a big pile of stones, and this will be so that you won't forget what I've done for you. A literal memorial, a literal physical memorial, kind of proto-cenotaph in the middle of the Jordan River where God parted this water so that they could get into the promised land. So yeah, as you say, it's kind of baked into the Jewish and the Christian story.
It's something about our humanity, isn't it? That because we are frail, because we have limited memories, because we, inevitably forgetting is part of being human. As a recognition of that, of our humanity and our human frailty, it's really important to make these physical reminders.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, God doesn't forget. God is infinite, has got perfect recall, but he knows that his people, his created people, will forget, which is why you have these repeated refrains. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who brought you out of slaves out of Egypt through the wilderness into the promised land, and you see that as being picked up in elements of kind of Christian liturgy, Christian traditions for a long time, going back to Jesus teaching his disciples the Lord's Prayer, have used kind of repeated motifs, spoken motifs, physical actions to remember, both, primarily, of course, in the Eucharist, in breaking bread, physically breaking bread, pouring wine into cups, drinking, eating, but also in saying repeated things, recalling the Lord's Prayer or kind of reciting prayers and collective liturgy as a way of remembering, is saying, I don't want to rely on my own, flawed thing. Here's written down for us, and we do it collectively. It's a form of collective remembering, is the kind of heart of Christian worship for many people.
So maybe here's a challenge for church leaders, not only in the UK, but elsewhere. If the governments are not doing this, shouldn't Christian churches be? Shouldn't we be taking the initiative and saying it's really important? We're going to, create a memorialization service. We're going to find ways of celebrating, particularly remembering those who sacrificed their lives in the NHS and other. It was other emergency workers, wasn't it? The paramedics.
Yeah,
a friend of mine was a paramedic who died, caught COVID in the early phases, and died. And many other people, emergency workers,
care home staff.
Transport workers,
a lot of those frontline workers who couldn't hunker down with a laptop in their spare room like the rest of us. Yeah.
So I think that's one take-home message. But it is I think this very human desire to just forget and is it part of the sort of the paganization of modern society, this loss of a sense of a bigger narrative, a bigger structure, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, is a kind of pagan.
Possibly. I don't know. I haven't thought about it from that perspective. I think there's something individualistic about it as well. We live in a time of hyper-individualism, and remembering is fundamentally a communal act. You're connected, and particularly, as the kind of military memorialization we've been talking about fades away. World War One is now, everyone who fought in World War One is dead. So when we remember and put a poppy on for World War One, we are connecting ourselves quite consciously and saying, I do not exist solely in 2024, but I am part of a chain. My great, great, great grandfather, my grand grandparents fought in this war, kind of on behalf of me, their unborn great, 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 great grandson. And I want to consciously choose to situate myself in that long chain of community Whereas I wonder if today we live in an age that's a bit more individualistic and a bit more atomized, and people think nothing to do with me. I'm focusing on the here and now and living for myself.
Yeah, no, I think all these things add in. So I think just before we finish, I would like just to finish with some more bad news. You know, this is the bad news podcast, I'm afraid, because COVID hasn't gone away, and there's been two things we just want to refer to, and one is the growing evidence about long COVID. I mean, we've mentioned it before, but I think one of the things that we now know, which we didn't know then, is that this COVID virus is very, very different from viruses such as influenza and other respiratory pandemic viruses. And that's because, to use the technical term, it's a neurotropic virus. It's a virus which actually invades the central nervous system. I mean, we did know that right from the beginning, because we knew that anosmia, the ability to smell, and taste, was a recognized early symptom.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And why was that? Answer, because it was actually invading through the olfactory bulbs, which are in your nose, and which plumb in directly into your nervous system. But recent studies, I'm afraid, have just given the bad news. So I was just reading about a very detailed study of patients requiring hospitalization with COVID, who were then studied later on, I think at a year of age, a variety of different dates, and they had the book thrown at them, including having MRI and so on. And basically what it showed was you could see substantial reduction in cognitive performance amongst all scores compared with controls, especially executive function. There was substantial and persistent ongoing increase in brain injury markers. So they had persistent evidence of brain injury markers.
Can you just explain what a brain injury marker is?
So this is something in the bloodstream. It's a marker of inflammatory proteins, which are known to be associated with brain inflammation. And you can pick them up in the bloodstream.
So it's a warning sign that there is maybe even not visible in MRI, but there is more damage to the brain tissue.
And it's ongoing. It's not just happened. Wow. It's evidence that there is ongoing brain inflammation. The MRI showed evidence of gray matter atrophy. So that's permanent loss of gray matter tissue, especially in the frontal part of the brain. Subjective symptoms of cognitive impairment, so people feeling, I can't think clearly, I've got brain fog. And their conclusion was the cognitive deficits in patients requiring hospitalization were equivalent to 20 years of aging.
Oof.
And associated with objective evidence of ongoing brain injury and reduced gray matter. So that was one study. Then another fascinating study was where they took healthy volunteers, 34 healthy volunteers aged 18 to 30 years, with no evidence they'd been previously infected. Oh, sorry, no, 18 showed signs of infection and 16 did not. But they then deliberately infected them with their informed consent and with ethics approval. And what they found was that there was significant difference in the cognitive scores between infected and uninfected out to 1 year. And again, they show that these continuing changes. So we know that there are hundreds of millions of people across the world with long COVID. We know that it's causing all kinds of complex problems, not just in the brain. It's causing problems with thrombosis. It's causing problems in the gut. It's causing problems with the lungs, with kidneys, inflammatory markers, and so on. And one estimate is that economically it's causing $1 trillion worldwide of loss due to lost employment and care needs and so on. And the worry is that fresh COVID infections are rising, and that means there are going to be more people developing long COVID. And there seems to be a new autumnal spike now in the US and the UK and several other places.
Yeah, there's a new variant known as XEC, which is apparently causing a spike in infections. There's a very interesting story in The Guardian also last week about where they interviewed a number of kind of senior immunologists and kind of virologists who said they were basically kind of baffled and perplexed and dismayed at the lack of interest in kind of the resurgence of COVID, even using language like it's a capitulation. One of them, Danny Altman, who's an immunologist at Imperial College London, he said this: to those who work in the field, the current attitude of acceptance to losing this war of attrition against COVID is puzzling and a little desperate. Our capitulation to the virus is a combination of a population where most are now many months or years from their last vaccine dose. And anyway, that vaccine wasn't very kind of well tailored to the current variant. There is a huge behavioral polarization between those who are worried about it and look for mitigation and those who think we must learn to live with it. And I think it comes back to what we talked about before, that kind of willful amnesia. And I count myself as one of these people. I have less than zero interest in kind of winding the clock back and having to think, oh, should I do a lateral flow test before I go to this party? Oh, is this room well enough ventilated for a meeting? I'll just pop my mask in for when I go on the bus. Like, I do not want to go there. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. I just want to live my life. I want to treat COVID like I treat the ordinary common cold or flu. Just one of those diseases that roll around. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't, whatever. And yet some of these experts are saying that's a massive mistake and we need to, you know, get back into the mindset of treating this as a really serious public health concern.
Absolutely right. And this is because it isn't flu and it isn't the common cold. It's a neurotropic virus that loves to invade the central nervous system and burrow in there and slowly rot it. And I suspect, I may be wrong, I hope I'm wrong, but I suspect in future years we will start to learn, you know, that a significant proportion of people with neurological problems, including dementia and so on, is all because of COVID infection. That it is building for us in the future a terrible burden. So,
but is it credible? I mean, like, I sometimes get a bit frustrated reading these kind of ivory tower academics talking about let's reintroduce mitigation factors. And I'm like, it just doesn't take account of human psychology. Yeah. Like, you need popular consent for people to go back to even, you know, a micro 10% of what we did in COVID. You know, no one's saying it's going to full lockdown, but like, I just think it just doesn't take into account human psychology, where people are just not prepared to suffer through those kind of deprivations of liberty and impositions on, you know, covering their faces and meeting outdoors. And I don't know, I just think, is it credible and realistic to kind of go back to that slightly alarmist phase?
Well,
do we just have to find a way as a society just to live with this? Even if it's suboptimal and it is rotting our brains, we have to find a way to live with this.
Well, that's a bit despairing, isn't it? The thing is, what is so frustrating, I think, to people in this field is that there's lots of evidence of new approaches to immunisation that could be incredibly protective. So back in 2022, there was a study in China of a new nasal vaccine, which makes a lot of sense, because actually the way this virus gets into us is through the respiratory tract. So sticking antibodies into your arm doesn't make a lot of sense. It makes much more sense to make sure that it's the respiratory tract, which is where you got all your immunity. And so a nasal virus turned out to have a very high protection against 10 different variants of SARS, because it worked in a different way, and yet there is apparently no scientific or commercial interest in developing this nasal vaccine or similar ones, just because people think, well, it's never going to make a lot of money, it's going to cost millions to develop, we're going to have to do large controlled trials. There's no appetite.
We've already got the ones, the jabs, you know, why do we need to do this all over again?
I think it is that level of denialism, of apathy, that why bother? And it is interesting to me, because this is, again, one of the challenges for democratic societies, isn't it? To what extent do you say, well, we're never going to persuade the ordinary people this is important, but we public health specialists, we know why it's important, and we and the government are just going to do this. You know, there hasn't been big discussions about polio vaccines or whooping cough vaccines. They have a bit. I mean, measles vaccines suddenly became very political, but now, thankfully, that's died down. Why isn't the government, why aren't governments across the world saying this is so important, we're just going to do it? But I suspect it is the politicization.
And there's a level of distraction, you know. I mean, I think the world has moved on very rapidly. It's a febrile, ever-changing, unstable world we live in. There are conflicts breaking out all over. There are trade wars. There are, you know, governments changing. I just think there is very little political bandwidth left. You know, the vaccines were originally procured at this moment of kind of perfect storm when everyone was locked down and we knew our only way out back to normality was to pour, you know, Manhattan Project style attention and resources, put our best minds and tens of billions of pounds into lightning fast producing these vaccines. And that moment has passed. And you know, if you go to the government in this country or in the US or anywhere else and say, could you now please devote 5 to 10% of GDP towards producing a next generation of nasal COVID vaccines, people would laugh at you. They would laugh at you.
Yeah, but it's nothing like that. We're not talking about anything of that order of magnitude. We're talking about, you know, millions, at the most a few billions, which is a tiny, tiny fraction. You know, politicians are spending those sums of money on lots of other things. Anyway, just interestingly, I just read this bit out from a written by a specialist physician in this kind of area. And he says this, writing to the general public, if you haven't, please consider getting the new booster. This is the latest version of booster vaccination. Extrapolating from previous data, it should provide about 50% protection from infection for 4 to 6 weeks, and it protect well against severe COVID for 4 to 6 months, and will help reduce the risk of developing long COVID. We need to use our brains rather than to leave them vulnerable to this god-awful virus.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, it's yeah, putting aside the rights or wrongs of it, I just think it's not going to happen. And I don't say that with any great relish, but I just think, yeah, the society, most people have made their mind up to leave COVID in the past. And I think a lot of these doctors and public health officials are going to be basically shouting into the wind, unfortunately, because we're led by the posture of our experts and our authority figures. And I see nothing from the government and chief medical officer and everything aren't. If they came out tomorrow and get a press conference and said, right, guys, COVID's still here, it's still dangerous, you could get brain damage from even a mild case, I'd love, you need to go out and get your boosters. I think me and tens of millions of other kind of loyal, obedient citizens would merrily troop down to their local GP surgery and get jabbed. But in the absence of that, it's just, you know, for me, it's at the same level as people saying, have you thought about getting a flu jab this winter? And I said, well, no, not really. I'm young and healthy and I never catch flu. I'll just carry on my life. Mm. It doesn't feel like an emergency. And I think until we have that kind of change in posture from the government and the kind of authority figures, I think a lot of these doctors and the like are going to be shouting into the wind for rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly.
Okay, well, on that
depressing
note, we shall maybe pull things together.
Wrap it up, yeah. Yeah, let us know what you think. Do you think we should be more alarmist or more denialist when it comes to COVID in 2024? Would you consider getting a booster and another vaccine? Have you got any questions from kind of reflecting on COVID? We did that episode, for those who didn't see it, last summer. We did a two-parter little mini-series where we went back over our kind of original COVID lockdown era episodes and kind of thought on the longer term implications of that. So do look at those. There's also an episode in the back catalogue about the origins of COVID, where we kind of tentatively dip our toe into some of that very ferocious debate about whether it was a natural spillover from a natural virus, or whether it got made in a lab in China and accidentally escaped the lab. So do look through. That was also in 2023. But yeah, get in touch with us, molad@premier.org.uk, and you can find lots and lots of material on COVID and other medical ethics questions on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com, and you can find out more about my journalism and sign up to my Substack newsletter by going to my website. That is tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.